This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, we're featuring some of our most entertaining interviews of the year. One of the more riveting TV performances this year was given by Margot Martindale in the FX series Justified. She won an Emmy for that performance. It was great to see her develop a character through an entire season of a series. I'd been impressed with her before in Million Dollar Baby, playing Hilary Swank's mother, in Paris Je T'aime, as a middle-aged woman whose life is changed by a trip to Paris, and in other roles, but it took me a while to realize that these performances were by the same person. Let's start with a scene from Justified. The series is about a deputy U.S. Marshal in Kentucky, played by Timothy Oliphant. In this year's arc, he investigated a family drug ring run by a very tough woman, Mags Bennett, and her sons. Mags was played by Margot Martindale. In this scene, she's disciplining her not very bright son, Coover, for leaving a paper trail that could incriminate the family. As this clip begins, she picks up a hammer.
I'm sorry, Mama.
Coover, I know you're sorry. That's why it's going to hurt so much to have to do this.
Hey! Put your hand on his stump! Hey, put your hand on his stump!
Take what's coming.
Mama,
I'm saving your gun hand now.
Mama, don't hurt me.
Cross me again and I will leave you.
Mama! Nothing.
Mama, you gotta do this.
You shut your mouth!
Mama!
Because you're crippled to the point of worthlessness. It ain't you down on that table. As it is, I have to hurt Cooper.
And I like Cooper.
Mama, I love you. Mama, I love you. Mama, no!
Margot Martindale, welcome to Fresh Air, and please don't hurt me.
Oh, that really makes me laugh.
It's such an amazing scene. And, I mean, you're playing it both ways. Like, you're the loving mother who has to do this as if you're about to spank your baby, but you're about to break his every finger in his hand with a hammer. But you're nice enough to spare his gun hand.
I know. Because
you love him that much.
So sweet.
Tell me what it was like to play that scene.
Well, you know, it was... Everything about this part just came so easily, and I had...
That scares me, I have to tell you.
I know, it's so crazy. But those boys were just fantastic. Brad Hinkey and Jeremy Davies and Joe Lyle Taylor, my sons. We had a blast. It was like doing a, you know, six-month movie. It was easy. That's all I can say. Very easy. That scene, the only thing I worried about was hurting his hand. It was a rubber hammer, but I kept saying, oh, please, Brad, if it hurts, let me know. And, of course, I think it hurt a little bit, but, you know, that's okay. He deserved it.
One of my favorite scenes in Justified is at, like, a town hall meeting. There's a big company, big coal mining company, that wants to buy out everybody's land so that they can, you know, that they can mine the mountains. And you get up. And you give this inspirational speech about the spirit of the mountain people and how you're not going to give in to big coal. And it sounds like a cross between, like, the documentary Harlan County, USA, which is about coal mining, you know, like destroying Kentucky, and Norma Rae. But the truth, which we find out a little later, is that the reason why you don't want people to sell their land is because you want to force the coal company to accept the deal you're about to offer. You want to hold them hostage to your deal, which would make you incredibly wealthy and basically give you a percentage of the company that owns the coal company. So all this Appalachian speechifying is just a way to cut out all the people and get the deal that benefits you. So I want to play that speech that you give at this town hall meeting. We'll hear an excerpt of it, and in the speech we'll also hear the coal mining company representative, Carol Johnson.
You know what happens when 500 million gallons of slurry breaks loose? The gates of hell open!
Those poundments are built strong to keep the slurry back.
The gates of hell open, and all that waste rolls down through the hollers and poisons the water and the land and everything it touches. Mining company has a word for those leavings, doesn't it? The spoil. The spoil. And that is what our lives will be if Black Pike has their way with our mountain.
With all due respect, Mrs. Bennett, Black Pike will replace the mountaintops and leave money. A lot of money in the pockets of the working people of Bennett and Harlan County.
That a fact.
Yes, ma'am, that is a fact.
Well, that's something to consider. Because it ain't an easy life here. No, ma'am. To an outsider, it's probably hard to understand why we're all not just lining up and saying, where do we sign? But we got our own kind of food. Our own music. Yeah. Our own liquor. We got our own way of courting and raising children and our own way of living and dying. And to protect all that, we have got to say no thank you to Miss Carol Johnson here in Black Pike Mine.
So that is such a great saying. I love when you go to, we have our own food, have our own way of living.
I tell you, they're just the greatest writers ever. They really are incredible.
Where did you go? Who did you watch? Did you watch movies? Did you visit Harlan County? What did you do to get into this?
I just came right out of me. I didn't do anything. I'm from Texas. I'm from East Texas. I'm from big land-owning people, big ranchers, big hunters, big athletes. They all talk like that. They're all smart and deceptive and powerful. And also, I lived 4 years in Kentucky at Actors Theater of Louisville. So it's all part of my makeup. You know, it's something I really understand. I'd like to say that I worked really hard and studied people and everything, but I didn't. It just came out of my imagination and the 60 years I've lived, truly.
I think one of your great tools is your voice. You have a really deep voice that you can make even deeper in roles like Justified. You can bring your voice from really like deep within. And I have to say that this is at a time when a lot of women speak in much higher voices, and when often our voices get more trapped in our throats for women. Mm-hmm. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about your voice and using how deep and full it can be in a role like your role on Justified,
where
you have to express power. You have to convey you've got the power.
Sometimes I worry that my voice is too buzzy, too round, that when I'm on stage, I really have to lift my voice. I have to put it in another spot so that you can hear me, because sometimes when you're down in this thing, you can't hear the enunciation as well. My voice is lower than both of my brothers, but one of them is not with me anymore, but my voice is lower than their voices. Texas men usually have a little bit higher voices like that, but mine's lower than, my mother had a very low voice too. So, I don't know, sometimes I feel that it is a plus, and sometimes I think that it gets in my way, my voice.
Why does it get in your way sometimes?
And maybe Justified has changed that for me in my head. Sometimes I think I have to pretty it up, girlify it, make it more, make it a little sweeter, a little softer, a little more, you know, have a little more, because everybody I talked to on the phone said, yeah, yes, sir, no, sir, I said, this is a woman. I've said, this is a woman, I must say, maybe 2,500 times in my life. This is a woman, and I get really pissy about it.
This is why I'm so grateful to the people on Justified for allowing you to, like, unleash your gifts.
they just let me run wild. Isn't that wonderful? It was really, really liberating, I can tell you that. It also, I think because I let it go, I let everything except that I loved to act and I loved to be honest and true to the character. That's all that I cared about. And I didn't care what I look like. I didn't care obviously I didn't care what I look like. I care what I look like. I care that I'm fat. I care, but Mags Bennett did not care. And I love that about Mags Bennett. So maybe,
well, her size is part of her power.
So maybe she's taught me something. I hope so.
You just described yourself as fat.
Yes.
I'd use the word plump or something, but
you're so sweet.
Thank you. But I read that when you were in high school, you were a cheerleader, and
I
you
was
were
a
like the football homecoming queen or something along those
I
lines.
I was the football sweetheart in the ninth grade. I was Miss Jacksonville High School in high school, but I was never the homecoming queen. Let's get that straight, because people really get mad when they read that.
But I imagine you had, you know, quite an attractive figure then to be a cheerleader.
I had a really lovely figure. I did. Surprise!
Did it upset you when you started putting on weight?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, uh-huh. I wore a body brace all during my teenage years. From when I was 12 until I was 15.
For like scoliosis or something?
For severe scoliosis. They think I had polio when I was 3, and that it, when my spine grew, that it grew crooked. So I wore a body brace, and I wore prism glasses to see. I was extremely small. And then when I got out of that brace, I put on, I'd say, 20 pounds almost immediately. Because I felt very vulnerable. So I...
Oh, because you didn't have this, brace protecting you.
I didn't have a body. I didn't have armor around me.
Yeah.
Yeah, so... But I'm talking... Then I weighed 140 pounds instead of 120 pounds. And then after my father died, I gained 70 pounds. Then I lost that 70 pounds. And I stayed all right until I had a child, and... And then I just said, to hell with it, and went with it.
The first time I noticed you was in the Clint Eastwood movie Million Dollar Baby, which starred Hilary Swank as a young boxer who was really kind of going against the odds because she's a woman, and she's being trained by an over-the-hill boxer trainer played by Clint Eastwood. And when she starts to win matches, she buys her mother, you, and her sister... and her sister's child, a house. Now, they're all on welfare. They don't really care about her. They're what some people might call white trash.
Yeah, some people.
When she takes you and your daughter to your new home that she bought you to surprise you all, the big surprise is your reaction. So here's the scene with Hilary Swank and you as her mother. You speak first.
How much money this cost?
You never mind that.
Well, you shouldn't have done this.
You need a decent place.
You shouldn't have done it. You should have asked me first. Darling, government's going to find out about this house. They're going to stop my welfare.
Oh, no, they ain't.
Yeah, they are. You're fine. You're working, but I can't live without my welfare.
Mama, I send you money.
What about my medicine? Medicaid going to cut me off. How am I supposed to get my medicine?
I'll send you more money.
I hope you don't expect J.D. to move in here with us. He's getting out, you know.
Why don't you just give me the money? Why'd you have to buy me a house?
I didn't have to, Mom. But it's yours. You want the money? Sell it.
What gratitude you display. In that scene, that was really just such a stunning role. I saw that and I was wondering, who is that actress? Because I don't think I'd really seen you in much before that, or I hadn't really noticed. So how did you prepare for this part, for instance?
You know, same kind of thing. I mean, it was sort of a lead-in to Justified, I think. I was in Los Angeles again. They asked me to come in and audition for that part. And I said, I want to wait till I get back to New York because I want this part. And I feel more comfortable auditioning in New York. It's a weird thing. You feel more comfortable at home. And I did the whole part. I learned the whole part. I did the whole part. And I think that's the way you get it for Clint Eastwood. If you're not a star, you really have to show him the whole thing done.
He was one of the stars of the film, playing the manager of the boxer. And there's a scene at the end after the young woman boxer, played by Hilary Swank, has broken her neck. She's lying helplessly in her bed. She's paralyzed from the neck down. and you and your daughter, like the whole family comes in, basically putting a document under her nose and telling her to sign it with her mouth because it's the only part of her body that moves, willing everything she owns to you for when she dies. And Clint Eastwood is in the doorway staring really hostily at you. And I'm wondering what the experience was like of having your director, because he directed the film as well, in the doorway staring hostily at you as you were trying to do your scene.
Oh, it, you know, honestly, that scene, the first part of the movie, first two scenes that I did, then I went home and my brother died.
Oh, my God.
And, and when I came back, he was so kind to me that what I really was doing during all of that last scene was trying very hard not to be emotional about it. So it was, everybody was extremely supportive, and it was all about me not giving in to my own life experiences during that time. He couldn't be more lovely and wonderful as a director and a person.
Would you mind if I asked how your brother died?
He died of outpatient surgery.
Oh, no. Well, like a staph infection or something?
No, no. He blew a blood clot in the morning. He went home after having some kind of hernia operation. And
oh, no.
And, you know, died. He called me before he got... Actually, he had a hernia operation and one of his testicles removed. I'm sorry, Tim. But... He called me when he got home. He said, hi, sister. I'm going to go to sleep. Then he said, I'm tired. I said, oh, Tim, you're ridiculous. And then he said, I'll call you tomorrow. And he was dead. So it was really shocking and hard. And he was 58 years old.
So he was an older brother.
He was 5 years older than me. Mm-hmm. And I have another brother 13 years older than me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm really sorry.
No, thank you.
So I'm thinking, you know, a lot of actors are given the advice to kind of play, like find the emotion within you, play yourself in a way, you know, be your version of that character. And from how you're describing it, you had to make sure you were not in touch with your emotions because your emotions are so raw. At that moment, did you have to draw on a completely different way of acting because what you were experiencing was so profound and so, you know, so bad? So you were in such grief.
You know, I never thought about that, but yes, I guess I did. Though I think that approaching that scene, I would have shut down that part of me anyway because I'm very empathic and I would have been affected emotionally by that scene as me. So I had to actually, like in Justified, shut down that part of me that feels for people. So that part of my brain was not there.
Earlier we talked about your voice, and it turns out that you have a great singing voice. There's a moment in Justified where you're on the porch and somebody says, oh, sing, and you go, oh, no. Of course, hoping that they'll keep asking, which they do. So you break out into song, and you sound great. So have you done musicals or anything like that?
I've done a lot of musicals. I love music. I love music. I would love to do a musical again. It's been a while.
Your husband's a musician, right?
Mm-hmm, he is. He's a lyric tenor. And
oh, he sings?
Uh-huh. He's fantastic.
Oh.
And so when I married him, I didn't think I could sing anymore because he can sing. I'm just incredibly musical. That's what he always says. You're extremely musical. So, but yeah, it's fun. I can sing. No, I'm not a great singer, but I can sing.
Well, Marco Martindale, it has been so great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Terry. I so appreciate it.
And here you are singing on the porch in Justified.
High on the mountain road, wind blowing free, thinking about the days that used to be. High on a mountain, standing all alone, wondering where the years of my life had flown.
My interview with Margot Martindale was recorded in September of this year, just before she won an Emmy for her performance as Mags Bennett in the FX series Justified. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Yo, 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 148, 3 to the 3 to the 6 to the 9, representing the ABQ. What up, biatch? Leave it at the tone.
That's how Aaron Paul used to sound as Jesse Pinkman in the early days of the AMC series Breaking Bad. Back then, Jesse was a teenager cooking and selling meth, working with his former chemistry teacher Walter White, played by Bryan Cranston. In season 4 this year, both were working for a drug lord and were in way over their heads. We're going to listen back to the interview I recorded with Aaron Paul in September as we continue our series featuring some of our most entertaining interviews of the year. Aaron Paul and Bryan Cranston have won Emmys for their performances on Breaking Bad. When the series began, Walt was diagnosed with advanced lung cancer, needing money for his treatment and wanting to leave money for his family when he died. He decided to use his chemistry expertise to cook crystal meth. His meth became legendary. Jesse, his former flunking student who was already cooking and selling meth small time, became Walt's assistant cook. Before Breaking Bad, Aaron Paul was best known for his performance in Big Love as Amanda Seyfried's husband. Let's start with a scene from the first season of Breaking Bad, soon after Walt and Jesse have teamed up. Jesse was supposed to sell the meth they just cooked and bring back the money. Walt is really angry when Jesse shows up late.
We were supposed to start at 3.
Hey, I'm out there making fat stacks, man. Chill. Hey, prepaid cell phone. Use it.
How much is this?
26 big ones.
Is that all? $26,000?
No, that's $2,600. And your share is 13. Minus 25 bucks for that phone.
How much meth did you sell?
Nearly an ounce.
Last time I checked, there were 16 ounces to a pound. What'd you do with the rest? Smoke it?
Yo, I've been out there all night slinging crystal. You think it's cake, moving a pound of meth 1/10 at a time?
So why are you selling it in such small quantities? Why don't you just sell the whole pound at once?
To who? What do I look like, Scarface?
This is unacceptable. I am breaking the law here. This return is too little for the risk. I thought you'd be ready for another pound today.
You may know a lot about chemistry, man, but you don't know jack about slinging dope.
Well, I tell you, I know a lack of motivation when I see it.
Oh, my God.
You've got to be more imaginative, you know? Just think outside the box here. We have to move our product in bulk, wholesale. Now, how do we do that?
What do you mean, to like a distributor?
Yes. Yes, that's what we need. We need a distributor. Now, do you know anyone like that?
Yeah, I mean, I used to, until you killed him.
Aaron Paul, welcome to Fresh Air. I love that scene.
Thank you so much.
And I love the way your former chemistry teacher, who's now your partner cooking meth, is lecturing you about your lack of motivation the way only a teacher could. Now, your character, Jesse, starts off as, I mean, he's a kid from the suburbs who's an underachiever, and he's modeled his look and his way of speaking on hip-hop culture, probably watched a lot of, like, Beastie Boy videos.
Yes, and absolutely.
You get the picture from the cell phone message that we played. Who did you model Jesse on early in the series?
Really, it was a combination of people that I've met throughout my life and people that I have encountered in New Mexico. And it's all over the place. And so I just kind of tried to form a unique, interesting personality through the people that I've encountered.
So we're into the fourth season of Breaking Bad now. Have you come close to counting how many times you've used the word bitch?
Oh, wow. The yos and bitches. It's too many to count. It's incredible. And all of those are scripted. Nothing. A lot of people ask me, do you just improv the yos or the bitches sometimes? And everything's on the page. It's great.
So your character, Jesse, was supposed to be killed off in the first season of Breaking Bad. How did you find out that your character was doomed? When did you learn that?
I didn't learn that until towards the end of the first season. We were on the sixth episode, so the fifth episode plus the pilot, and we had one more to go, and I hadn't read the script yet. And Vince, we were at lunch, and Vince is...
This is the creator, Vince Gilligan.
Yeah, this is creator Vince Gilligan, calls me over, and he's, you know, eating with all the writers, and he goes, "I want to tell you something." And I go, "What's that?" And he goes, "Originally, Jesse was supposed to die at the end of this season." This is the first time I've ever heard any of this. And instantly, my heart kind of dropped and slowed down a bit. And he goes, "But we don't think we're going to do that anymore." And I was like, "What do you mean? What are you talking about? Like, what's the plan?" And he's like, "No, I just want to let you know that that's not the plan anymore." And I didn't know how to take it, but he said that they just love the dynamic between Walt and Jesse and the chemistry that Brian and I kind of brought to these characters. He decided to change the whole dynamic of their relationship and really of the show. But the entire second season, the entire third season, I thought that Jesse could be a goner at any moment, because there's, you know, many things that this character has screwed up on, and you know, he could definitely meet his deathbed at any moment. So, and they'd always tease me. They'd always joke around saying, "Oh, did you read the next script?" And I would say, "No, not yet. I haven't got it. You know, I haven't got it." And, you know, Brian would come up and give me a hug and say, "Well, I'm not going to say anything, but, you know, it was such a pleasure working with you. It's been an amazing past year and a half. And, you know, you have a huge career ahead of you." And so they would always joke around about it. They kind of slowed down this fourth season, but we'll see. Who knows? I mean, this kid could die at any second.
Well, when I interviewed Vince Gilligan, he basically said he couldn't imagine the series without you.
Oh, I love that man. How nice is he?
But they also made it clear that's no guarantee. So, but you know, that kind of uncertainty, I could see that being a little helpful, because Jesse's never sure how long he's going to live. So
right. Why
should you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's true.
Jesse's changed so much in the course of the now four seasons of the show. And, you know, he starts off really small time. You know, he's almost like still a kid. And now he's involved with this big drug ring, and where there's a lot of violence, a lot of money. At the end of season three, last season, Walt is afraid that the head of the drug ring is going to kill him as soon as Walt has finished training his assistant cook, a man named Gail, in how to prepare the meth recipe. And if the head of the drug ring kills Walt, he'll probably kill Jesse too. So Walt thinks the only hope is to have Jesse kill this assistant meth cook, Gail. So he convinces Jesse that Jesse has to murder the assistant cook. And so you, Jesse, kill Gail, and then you just really become dead inside afterwards. So you kill him, you're dead inside, you start using meth again, and then you end up going to your support group, your drug support group. You want to confess that you've killed a man, but you can't confess that. So you make up a story that you've killed a dog. And here's a clip from that scene in the support group.
A couple weeks back, I killed a dog. You hit it with your car? No, I put him down. I watched him go. I was looking them straight in the eye. And he didn't know what was happening. He didn't know why. He was just scared. And then he was gone.
And then members of the support group try to comfort Jesse, and one of them says, oh, well, the dog was suffering. Putting him down was a kindness. And then when Jesse says, that's not what happened, the woman in the group assumes, oh, well, the dog must have bitten someone, so you did the right thing. And then you say it wasn't that. And then another person in the group assumes, like, well, you must have started using meth again, and that took you to the dark side, because that's what meth does. And everybody's trying to help you justify killing this dog, and you know that there's really no justification for what you've done, which is killing a man. So let's pick up the scene from there, and the leader of the support group speaks first.
How'd you feel about what you did, Jesse?
I don't know.
Who cares how you feel? What kind of a person kills a dog for no reason?
Colleen.
You put an ad in the paper, you drop him off at a shelter, you don't just sit there and talk about killing a helpless, innocent animal.
We're not here to sit in judgment.
Why not? Why not? Maybe she's right. You know, maybe I should have put it in the paper. Maybe I should have done something different. The thing is, if you just do stuff and nothing happens, what's it all mean? What's the point? Oh, right, this whole thing is about self-acceptance.
Kicking the hell out of yourself doesn't give meaning to anything.
So I should stop judging and accept.
To start.
So no matter what I do, hooray for me because I'm a great guy. It's all good. No matter how many dogs I kill, I just do an inventory and accept. I mean, you back your truck over your own kid and you like accept? What a load of crap.
Hey, Jesse, I know you're in pain.
No, you know what? Why I'm here in the first place is to sell you meth. You're nothing to me but customers. I made you my bitch.
You okay with that? Huh? You accept?
No. About time.
That's my guest Aaron Paul as Jesse Pinkman in a scene from this season of Breaking Bad. You are so lost at this point in the storyline. Do you feel like the character you're playing now is different from the character you started playing on Breaking Bad? Because so much has happened to him. He's changed so much.
Oh, wow, 100%. He is so broken now. I mean, he was a lost kid at the beginning of the series. You know, just kind of struggling to find his way, but he was content with dime bagging it, you know, just selling teens at a time and living in his aunt's house. But when Mr. White comes back into his life and they continue to go down this dark rabbit hole and they can't seem to get out of it, they're both so in way over their heads. And now, you know, Jesse has completely, really lost the support of his family. He had lost his first really true love, I think, with Jane. That was started off as a good influence on Jesse, but then just turned into a chemical romance, really. And now, you know, he's a murderer, and he's just lost and tortured, and it's so tragic what he's going through.
And murder really isn't in his nature. But no. He's had to do it, and he has to live with the consequences of that. Did you have to figure out who is Jesse without the drugs and the poses?
Yeah. I really, you know, joining this series, obviously I had no idea where this character was going, and I didn't really have much of a backstory. But as the seasons have gone on, I feel like I have a true grasp of who this kid is, inside and out. And it's incredible how I feel like such a personal connection with Jesse. feels like he's almost a part of me, to be honest. But I couldn't be such a polar opposite from this kid. But going to work every day and kind of zipping on his skin is such a, you know, such a dream.
What makes you the opposite of Jesse Pinkman?
I feel like I have my life together, really. And Jesse just seems like he's constantly just struggling to keep his head above water. And he's just this, you know, messed up kid trying to find his way. But, you know, he has this soul. He has this heart. I mean, that's why I feel people are rooting for him. And they just want to, you know, hug him and tell him it's going to be okay. But at the end of the day, like, is it really? Is it going to be? You don't know.
He wouldn't accept that hug anyways.
No, he actually would not, no.
You've taken a lot of punishment in the series. You've been beaten in a lot of very imaginative ways. Would you have problems watching scenes like when you're beaten up or scenes when your face has been beaten to a pulp? Do you watch yourself in those scenes?
I do, yeah. I mean, I'll watch it when the show airs, you know, whether it being if I fly home to Idaho and I'm with my family, they'll, you know, they have a Breaking Bad night every week. And so I come from a huge, huge loving family, and they've been supportive since, you know, from day one. And so my parents are, you know, they're still madly in love. It's their 40th anniversary coming up in November. And I have many siblings. I have 14 nieces and nephews, and they throw a huge party. Yeah, they throw a huge party every Sunday night. That's pretty great.
Your co-star, the star of the series Breaking Bad, is Bryan Cranston. Did you know him from Malcolm in the Middle? I mean, from watching him on Malcolm in the Middle, in which he played the father?
Oh, yeah, I loved him. I loved that show. I thought he was great.
And how old were you when you first started watching that?
Oh, man, I was in L.A. When they were casting that pilot. I remember reading that pilot, and I went out for the older brother. Didn't end up getting it, obviously.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah, yeah. And Chris Masterson ended up getting the role, and he was brilliant on it. But, yeah, I was a huge fan of that show from day one. I think I've probably seen pretty much, like, every episode. But my mom is the biggest Malcolm in the Middle fan. She's obsessed.
Maybe that helped ease the blow that you're going to play somebody who cooks meth in the series.
Yeah, exactly. When I told her that Bryan Cranston was the star of Breaking Bad, the pilot that I had just booked, she lost her mind. She was so, so, so excited because she knew one day she would be able to meet him, you know? So she was ecstatic.
So you're obviously very different from the Jesse Pinkman character that you play on Breaking Bad. In fact, you know, he's a meth head. You grew up in Idaho. Your father is a Baptist minister, yes?
Yes, yeah, yeah. He's actually retired. He doesn't have a church he does every week anymore, but he still does, you know, weddings and funerals, and sometimes will guest speak at some churches. But, yeah, throughout my entire life growing up in Idaho, we would go, you know, to his congregation every week, and he would preach. And
what was his preaching like?
It was great. It was inspiring, really. I mean, he would get up in front of all these people and kind of just get lost in the moment as well. And I think that's where I take, not that I'm saying he was really standing up there acting, but he would just really get lost into these stories he would speak. And you know, I left at such a young age.
Left Idaho and left home?
Left Idaho, yeah. I left Idaho at 17. You know, I graduated high school a year early and just, you know, the typical story, packed up my car and moved out.
When you left home at age 17, which, as you point out, is really young, did your parents try to, like, bar the door and do everything in their power to prevent you from going and telling you that you were making a huge mistake that you would always regret, that you were throwing your life away and throwing away everything that they had ever done to help you in life, etc.?
You know what? Not at all. It was quite the opposite. I always had the plan of moving to LA. They knew I always wanted to do this. And I think really in eighth grade, I made it certain just to let my parents know this was my plan. You know, I'm going to move to like California or New York, and I'm going to try to become an actor. And so when I started taking it very seriously in high school, and they would see, you know, these productions that we put on, and they'd see how excited I would get about them, they were all about it when I mentioned to them that I wanted to take 0 hour, where I'd go to school early, you know, to do an extra class and take correspondence, which was really homeschooling as well, just to graduate early so I could get out to LA. They just applauded me and they said, go for it, just do it. You want this. Like, I love your passion. And most of my teachers were supportive, but there was this one teacher that came up to me when I was saying goodbye, really, because I had graduated, I'm done. And she said, I feel that you're making a big mistake, and what is your plan B? I mean, do you have another plan if this doesn't work out? Like, what if it doesn't work out? And when I told my mom that, because from everywhere, I was getting blessings from every side, but I told my mom that, and my mom went straight into the school and just said, how dare you say this to my son? Like, what's your plan? What's your second plan? What if this doesn't work out for you? You know, what's your plan B? And it was just so great to see my mom like take that control, because I've never seen her like that in my life. And it was just so great that they were supportive of going after dreams.
Well, they must have had a lot of faith in you and in your ability to follow through on the dream.
Yeah, no, obviously I couldn't have done this without them, and it's incredible. Very, very blessed.
So you get to L.A., and then what? You don't know anybody there. You don't...
Yeah, no, I mean, I know.
You have your car, it's packed up, then what?
Yeah, my mom came out with me, found a little studio apartment, and she just wanted to make sure I would get settled. And it's funny, like the weekend I was moving into this little tiny studio apartment in North Hollywood, a bank robbery is in progress, like two blocks from my place. A giant bank robbery, and it ended in crazy bloodshed. And my mom is like, oh my God, where am I allowing my son to move to? But she got on a plane and went back to Idaho and felt, I'm sure, very safe. But I'm sure she was scared for my life. But she was still very, very, very supportive. But, yeah, I didn't know anybody. I just, saved up a bunch of money from random jobs I worked in Idaho and just tried to find myself an agent and a manager.
And succeeded?
And succeeded, yeah, yeah.
You just talk them into it or what?
Yeah, I just talked them into it and bribed them a little bit, but I didn't bribe them. I ended up going to this this acting competition that was held downtown Los Angeles, and I mean there's just thousands of kids there, and I ended up signing with a manager there, and then he found me an agent pretty quickly, a couple weeks later. And that agent, Locke Powell, is now my manager, and I've been with him since day one. And I really owe everything to him. He's great.
Well, you paid off. So, can I just say something about the voice that you do as Jesse?
Yeah.
There's something about the voice that Jesse always seems to be on the verge of, like, complaining or whining or feeling put upon. It's like he's still a teenager, you know what I mean? It's like still his parents are nagging him or his teacher's nagging him. That's his kind of like posture in the world a lot of the time.
Right, yeah. It's true.
Is that what you've been trying for vocally?
Yeah, no, I mean, I see Jesse as this kid that still hasn't found his footing, you know? And I love that, he still calls Walter White Mr. White.
Yeah, yeah, that's so great.
he's just lost in his own own world. And I don't know, I think, well, you know, this season is where he's really, he's kind of taking the reins of his life.
Well, I just want to say, if Vince Gilligan is listening, please do not kill off Jesse Pinkman.
Yes, I agree. Thank you so much.
Aaron Paul, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Terry.
Aaron Paul plays Jesse Pinkman on the AMC series Breaking Bad. Our interview was recorded in September. It's part of our week-long retrospective of some of our favorite entertainment and pop culture interviews of the year. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Soman, and Teresa Madden. Our show was directed today by Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Time don't fool me no more. I throw my watch to the floor. It's gone crazy. Time don't do it again. Now I'm stressed and strained. Anger and pain in the subway train.
Now it's 2:30.
Long gone the rendezvous.
Now it's 2:30.